America's enthusiasm for the Fed going on the attack against working people, it gets the basic facts wrong. Wage pressures have turned out not to be, as its memo claims, hard to reverse. If you did see continually accelerating wage growth, it would be a problem. Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a liberal Washington, D.C. think tank, told Intercept in an email, adding that would almost certainly mean a wage price spiral with ever higher inflation. However, nominal wage growth has slowed sharply from around a 6% annual rate to just over 4% in recent months. So Bank of America wants the Fed to raise rates and unemployment to attack a problem. The memo, therefore, tells Americans what they suspected all along. The most powerful economic actors in the U.S., entities like Bank of America and its clients, do not like working people to have power, but it's nice to have it in their own words. Harris, the author, was not available for comment.
Yemeni men, ominous shadows.
Part 2.
The war in Yemen was in fact a combination of three battles. Everyone knows about the first war, the resistance by the Ansarullah against the Saudi invasion and the forces supported by Mohammed bin Salman. The second war is a conflict between the Houthis and the Al-Qaeda militants who are supported by Riyadh to make Yemen insecure and crush the Houthis who are Zaydi Shias. But we've heard less often about Yemen's third war. On April 27, 2017, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, Mohammed bin Salman's crony, who claims to be Yemen's president, deposed Idarus Qasim Abdul Aziz Al Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, the capital of former South Yemen. The reason for his dismissal was the vast relationship between Zubaydi and a tiny nation on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf. The newly established United Arab Emirates. After the dismissal, a large crowd of Zubaydi supporters took to the streets. The supporters were mobilized by the UAE. Hadi was informed through Saudi agents that the United Arab Emirates was behind all of this. It wasn't the first time that Hadi and bin Salman were informed of the UAE's spontaneous measures. Last winter, Hadi, who usually resided in Saudi Arabia, decided to visit Aden, that was the largest city controlled by the Saudi-backed militants. When Hadi's plane approached the airport in Yemen, as a rule of thumb, it requested to land, but the airport in Yemen didn't allow the plane to land. So the plane had to land kilometers away on the island of Socotra. Hadi was enraged. He fired the director of the airport and ordered the forces under his command to besiege the airport. The UAE-backed forces opened fire at Hadi's forces at the airport. So, the rift that everyone was already aware of opened wider. The rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia,
بين الإمارات والسعودية.
Bin Salman had sensed the danger and initially decided to act as the big brother and impartial mediator to forge reconciliation between Hadi and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, who's also the UAE's deputy commander-in-chief, Bin Zayed. 2 weeks later, Hadi left for Abu Dhabi, but talks took only 10 minutes. Bin Zayed reminded Hadi that the UAE has paid a lot of money to liberate Yemen. And Hadi told Bin Zayed that the UAE acts like an occupying power in Yemen, not a country that's deployed forces to liberate it. Hadi decided to fire the UAE cronies in his government, which itself was designated by Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman was supposed to teach the UAE a lesson and force them to support Saudi policies and stop going their own way. Finally, on April 27, 2017, Bin Salman gave Hadi the green light to punish the UAE. Adarus Qasim al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, and Hani Ali bin Breik, one of the ministers of Hadi's cabinet, were fired. The UAE reacted quickly. A massive protest in Aden. This time, the groups in Aden sought independence in South Yemen. For decades, Yemen had been divided into two northern and southern parts. North Yemen, whose capital was Sana'a, gained independence from the Ottoman Empire in the last year of the First World War in 1918. But South Yemen remained under British control for several decades later. Aden, the capital of South Yemen, was an important port for UK colonial ships in West and South Asia for decades. In 1969, South Yemen became independent. 21 years later, in 1990, South Yemen became united with North Yemen. 30 years later, the unity was about to collapse due to the UAE's meddlesome policies. After the war in Yemen, Hadi forces backed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia managed to occupy parts of what was called South Yemen in the past. North Yemen was still in control of Ansarullah forces, so South Yemen had turned into the only shelter for the Saudi-backed rebels. In January 2018, Zubaydi announced that the process of deposing Hadi in Aden had started. Now, a new front has opened for MBS. On January 28th, all administrative buildings of Hadi's government in Aden were captured. The SDC controlled the city. The spring in 2018 started while the Emiratis made another new move. The beginning of the threat to the Western interests in Bab el-Mandab Strait. After China came to the region, everyone got worried. Now, the Persian Gulf Arab states consider control over the strait a major part of security in their region. Soon, Turks, Japanese, and Americans showed up for trade and gaining a foothold on the African side of the strait. The carnage of people in Yemen, famine, disease, hunger, and ruining all welfare indices were the costs that the Yemenis had to pay so the UAE could progress. With former U.S. President Donald Trump's mediation, on August 13, 2020, the UAE signed the normalization deal with the occupying regime of Israel. The STC immediately reacted. Ben Brake, who was the commander of the STC forces, much before the agreement, had announced in winter of 2018 that he would support any reconciliation agreement with the Zionist regime. If the UAE had put its own interests as well as the occupying regime's interests in the same basket, it can continue to enjoy the U.S. support and Bin Salman wouldn't dare to interfere. A large part of Yemen's coastal territories, from Aden to the Red Sea, is occupied by the UAE and UAE-backed forces. The UAE is not that interested in the depth of the Yemeni territory. The goal is merely to control the sea. But why? On the southern coast, China has a naval base in Djibouti. The proximity of the UAE and the Israeli regime preserves U.S. interests against China's expansionist policies in Bab el-Mandab Strait. The U.S. cannot deploy forces in every region on its own. Huge military costs have already triggered protests inside the United States. That's why the U.S. put the heavy burden of the uprising in Yemen on the Saudis' shoulders. Bin Salman purchased U.S. weapons to crack down on the uprising. The U.S. was in fact killing two birds with one stone. Trump has said time and again, if Arabs want the U.S. to help them militarily, they have to pay for it. But Saudi Arabia isn't a long-term investment for the U.S. The title of the custodian of the two holy mosques bars the Saudi rulers from openly revealing their ties with Israel. What's more, Saudi Arabia is too large. The ideal situation for the U.S. and Israel in West Asia is to divide the countries into smaller nations the size of the UAE. The Israeli regime can't directly interfere in Yemen. It needed a middleman because of the small size of Israel, its limited military capabilities, and the hatred of Muslims against the occupiers of Al-Quds. The middleman should have been as reliable as Saudi Arabia, and at the time, it should have been so small and fragile that it won't pose any threat to Israel in the future. There is a policy in the U.S. that's officially called QME, or the so-called Qualitative Military Edge of Israel. Based on the policy declared by the U.S., which has been accepted by all U.S. administrations, Israel should have the highest military power in the Middle East. That's why Israel was against the sale of super advanced F-32 fighter jets to the UAE, even during the time Abu Dhabi was normalizing ties with Israel. Israel's opposition to the UAE's possession of such weapons proves the point Iran has mentioned for years. Israel doesn't have a problem just with Iran. Israel has a problem with every Muslim nation in the region that has military edge and the capability to respond. Israel even has a problem with countries that have extended hands of friendship to it. For sure, Israel's desirable condition for the region is to see it divided into many pieces. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, or the UAE, it doesn't make any difference. Bigger nations are definitely top on the agenda, a reality people like Bin Salman will find out too late, when the Saudis can't do anything about it anymore. In the middle of all this, Yemenis fall victim to preserving Israel's alleged edge in the region, so Bab al-Mandab will be a safe route for the West to transit goods and energy, a world that's aging and is aware that it's going to perish soon. The tiny nation of the UAE was allowed to play the role of Washington's advisor and agent in the region. An example that the U.S. used the UAE as a tool can be seen in this case. The launch of the Amal or Hope Mars rover that belonged to the United Arab Emirates. It belonged to the UAE because the UAE had paid for it, but the technology doesn't have anything to do with the UAE. And it's obvious why. The UAE needs to have missile industry to launch the satellite. It needs to have ballistic missile technology. The U.S. hasn't allowed any of its allied countries to have missile technology. So, the UAE doesn't have the right to have missiles. Why? Again, the answer is hidden within QME. Preserving Israel's so-called qualitative military edge in the region. Yet, the UAE is useful for Israel and the West as an infantry in crisis-stricken Yemen. The UAE spends money so the Yemeni coasts will be controlled by forces it backs and sets a firm foothold for Israel's spy agencies in the strategic Bab al-Mandab region. Israel does the work under the name of the UAE. Milking a cow is an idiom in English, meaning taking advantage of other people's resources to achieve your own goals. These days, the West has found a new way to communicate with third world countries. Let them spend, but for us. The UAE has nothing to do with Mars. It is too small to be preoccupied with such missions, and it doesn't have the necessary human resources. The UAE has the same situation in Yemen. Until December 2019, the Yemen war had cost $29 billion. It was a huge burden mainly on the shoulders of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. The UAE doesn't have military forces either, so it had to make military service for men under 30 years of age mandatory. In 2015, 45 of UAE soldiers were killed in Ma'arib in an attack by the Houthis. These are the new costs the Emiratis weren't aware of. The humanitarian costs in the Emirati society are higher. The society has never experienced democracy and doesn't consider the government an elected body. What the society witnesses are the decisions by hereditary rulers and the bodies of the sons who go back home in body bags. The trade towers in the UAE are in an even more fragile situation. they're almost defenseless in the face of Houthi attacks. The slightest strike on the UAE will take the international economic spotlight away from the tiny nation. The UAE takes all the risks while the US doesn't even spend a dollar and doesn't lose even a single soldier, or in other words, the US is milking the cow. On February 9th, 2020, the UAE military forces withdrew from Yemen, but it didn't mean that the UAE's presence in Yemen was over. 90,000 militia forces in Yemen are fighting for the UAE and with the UAE's funds. What's more, the UAE has left a heritage in Yemen, the STC, or the Southern Transitional Council. It's the UAE's proxy force that seeks Yemen's disintegration and an independent South Yemen with Aden as its capital. The UAE withdrew from the military conflict in Yemen and left Saudi Arabia to its own devices. At the same time, Sudan, that's under the influence of UAE petrodollars, downsized its forces from 15,000 down to 650. Now, the UAE has established a firm foothold in the region. It abandoned Saudi Arabia, so it pays the financial and humanitarian costs of the conflict on its own. But the UAE's proxy forces will benefit from the war. They had put Saudi-backed Hadi's rule at risk. The UAE's desirable outcome was providing a secure path for trade with the West and the Zionist regime. Both coasts are controlled by the Israeli regime, either here in Aqaba or here in the Mediterranean. They need this strait to be connected to Asia. The UAE and its proxy forces have controlled one side of the strait. The conflict followed an economic siege on Yemen. While the Emirati sheikhs construct fancy high-rises, Yemeni children go without food and medicine and have ended up in this situation. Many of them die of extreme hunger. But as long as Bab al-Mandab has trade values for the West, the deaths of thousands or even millions of Yemenis isn't considered a serious problem for those who wield power and wealth, and it's the media's job to shed crocodile tears. No one will remember thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children who've lost their lives in Yemen. The last popular force in Yemen, the Ansarullah, is the only bastion that's standing up against arrogant powers in the world, but it's an unequal war. The economic siege of Yemen is a silent massacre that's supposed to win the war for the West. These days, Saudi Arabia is the big loser of the war. After 3,000 deaths, heavy damage to the oil industry, and billions of dollars paid for the war, without any hope to win, launching more airstrikes and killing more Yemeni children are the only things that Saudi pilots can do perfectly well. But the UAE has so far ditched Saudi Arabia very well. Even though it paid part of the billions-dollar bill of the war, in 2019, it pulled out of the war and left Riyadh alone. ...108 Emirati soldiers have been killed. It is a major and unprecedented blow in the history of the UAE, but compared to the Saudi loss, it isn't so much. It's also received the best chunk of the cake. the ports and the trade chokeholds like Aden Port, Babu Mandab, and Socotra Island, namely everything that was once controlled by the British colonial power. The UAE betrayed Saudi Arabia, but with the U.S. support and the promise of reconciliation with Israel, the sheikhs in Abu Dhabi have to always watch out. It isn't clear when the U.S. and Israel will betray the Emirati sheikhs. In this game, everyone is ready to blow the right strike at the right time. The UAE already knows that it's shorter than the other players, so it will have to fight tooth and nail for its own survival. The story will continue.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله Peace be upon you Oh the second thought Allah Peace be upon you Oh the second thought Allah Assalamu alayka Ya Abu Abdullah Assalamu Ya Aba Abdullah, peace be upon you. Oh, the second thought, Allah, peace be upon you. Oh, the second thought, Allah. Assalamu alaykum, ya Ahla Bayt al-Nubuwa. Assalamu alaykum. يا أهل بيت النبوة وموضع الرسالة ومختلف الملائكة ومهبط الوحي ومعدن الرحمة Peace be upon you, O household of prophethood. Peace be upon you, O household of prophethood, and location of the divine mission, and frequently visited by the angels, and destination of the divine revelation, and core of mercy. And core of mercy Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah Assalamu Peace be upon you, O the second thought Allah. Peace be upon you, O the second thought Allah.
What you just heard was a lamentation for Chief of Martyrs Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, performed at Tehran University Mosque by members of the Saradla Group of Mourners of Tehran University Medical School.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the former Chancellor Rishi Sunak has admitted taking money from deprived urban areas in order to give it to other parts of the country. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rajiv Sial. The piece is titled Rishi Sunak Admits Taking Money from Deprived Areas. Thank you. In Britain, the former Chancellor Rishi Sunak has admitted taking money from deprived urban areas in order to give it to other parts of the country. The former Chancellor, who is standing to be Prime Minister, made the claim last month while speaking to Conservative Party members in Tunbridge Wells in Kent. In video footage obtained by the New Statesman, Rishi Sunak said, "I managed to start changing the funding formulas to make sure areas like this are getting the funding that they deserved. We inherited a bunch of formulas from Labour that shoved all the funding into deprived urban areas, and that needed to be undone. I started the work of undoing that." Tunbridge Wells has a Tory majority of 14,645 and has been held by the party since the constituency was created back in 1974. An analysis by The Guardian in February found that, under Boris Johnson's levelling up agenda, some of the wealthiest parts of England, including areas represented by government ministers, were allocated 10 times more money per capita than the poorest parts of England. The analysis brought together the four main levelling up funds for the first time: the Future High Streets Fund, the Community Renewal Fund, and the Towns Fund have been fully allocated, while the Levelling Up Fund has allocated £1.4 billion, with a further £1.8 billion still to be announced. A total of £4.7 billion has been allocated in England across the four schemes so far. It is not clear from the video to which funding formula or levelling up fund Rishi Sunak is referring to. Labour's Lisa Nandy, the shadow levelling up secretary, said, "This is scandalous. Rishi Sunak is openly boasting that he fixed the rules to funnel taxpayers' money to rich Tory shires. This is our money. It should be spent fairly and where it's most needed, not used as a bribe to Tory members. Talk about showing your true colours." Rishi Sunak's Conservative colleagues, however, were divided over the footage. The Foreign Office Minister, Zach Goldsmith, said, "This is one of the weirdest and dumbest things I've ever heard from a politician." Jake Berry, the chair of the Northern Research Group of Tory MPs, said that, in public, Sunak claims he wants to level up the North, but here he boasts about trying to funnel vital investment away from deprived areas. He says one thing and does another, from putting up taxes to trying to block funding for our armed forces and now levelling up, Berry, a Liz Truss supporter, said. But Rishi Sunak's supporters rallied around him, with the Conservative Tees Valley Mayor, Ben Hoochan, arguing that Johnson led the party to electoral victory on a pledge to invest in areas that have been ignored at the expense of urban cities. The Public Accounts Committee, the Parliament's spending watchdog, has been critical of the lack of rules over the Towns Fund. The Levelling Up Fund is supposed to create economic growth, but with no clarity of what that means and no measurements of success. Responding to Rishi Sunak's words, Meg Hillier, the chair of the cross-party Parliamentary Affairs Committee, told The Guardian, "This is evidence of a deliberate decision to change public spending priorities based on who you know. Pork barrel politics is unfair on taxpayers, and the areas that don't get the funding cannot even begin to qualify for the cash in a game with no rules." Rishi Sunak is reported to be trailing Liz Truss in the race to succeed Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, as party members begin voting. But there is still a month of the campaign to go, with the result to be announced on 5th of September. Both candidates appeared at another hustings event on Friday evening, 5th of August, this time in Eastbourne in East Sussex, where they took questions from Tory members. Rishi Sunak's campaign did not dispute the video, but argued that he had moved the cash from inner city areas to towns and poorer rural areas. A source said, "Levelling up isn't just about city centres, it's also about towns and rural areas all over the country that need help too." That's what he changed in the Green Book, and he will follow through as Prime Minister. They added, travelling around the country, he's seen non-metropolitan areas that need better bus services, faster broadband, or high-quality schools. That's what he'll deliver as Prime Minister. The government was criticised last year for the terms of the Levelling Up Fund after it emerged that dozens of Conservative regions were placed in the top tier for assistance despite their relative affluence. Ministers responded to the backlash by saying that they did not have any of the political influence suggested and have left the scheme in the hands of civil servants. In 2020, Robert Jenrick, the then Community Secretary, admitted that he and a junior minister approved payments to towns in each other's constituencies from another government fund earmarked for deprived areas.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. it's now widely believed that the US has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. And then six zones, military exercise zones, have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days, just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the US and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the US refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the U.S. decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the U.S. formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the U.S. policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the U.S. government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification, but neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as they China succeeded in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony. The United States says it has killed the Al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed a ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was an employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Azawahiri's death. Azawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to Al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Azawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of US troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal. The US invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out Al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The US-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish US politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth, as the Taliban, of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the Al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan. And we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and the ISIL.
The war in Yemen has killed thousands of people and left a large portion of the population on the verge of starvation. But 2 months ago, a spark of hope was reignited among the Yemenis. The Saudi-backed coalition and the Ansarullah resistance movement announced an extension to the 2-month truce, which was agreed upon in April. But now, the same hope has transformed into fear and anxiety for the civilians as the war-ravaged country awaits two scenarios: a new cycle of war or an extended cessation of conflict. The United Nations-sponsored truce has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war. But even though the truce lasted despite multiple violations from the Saudi side, there have been no reports of an extension. As the expiration approached, the UN ramped up its efforts to renew the agreement, which it says has resulted in improved humanitarian conditions and has led to a significant decrease in civilian casualties. The truce brought immense relief to civilians, but its true potential regarding effectiveness and longevity remain under question. One issue that persists is Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement being dissatisfied with its implementation, saying the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its obligations. Experts have also criticized the truce for failing to address the main and underlying issues behind the war.
Well, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudis, who did block shipments and engaged in a couple of skirmishes, but it was still much better than the previous state of affairs. And that currently it seems to be expiring without serious action to make it permanent, for presumably mainly because, the Saudis are not willing to let go of this stranglehold they've got right now on Yemen, and they're not willing to let go of their hopes for establishing a puppet regime and getting control of this geostrategically crucial area. And the West has apparently decided to let them.
Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen with the objective of installing a Riyadh-friendly regime and crushing the Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement. But while the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its goals, the war has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing war on Yemeni people has also sparked global outrage over grim violations of human rights. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has voiced concern over the torture and ill-treatment of Yemenis by the United Arab Emirates, armed forces, state security agencies, and on-state armed groups. Earlier this year, the UN expressed concern regarding the civilian casualties in Yemen. Many rights organizations have also condemned the acts of aggression against the Yemenis, especially children and women, and denounced the continued international silence on the crimes. But the June ceasefire, especially its extension in April, raised the prospects of peace in a country that has only faced destruction and gloom over the past years.
Well, it would be nice if a habit of peace had been established so that the hot war doesn't break out again right away. But again, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudi side. And the fact that they haven't been able to extend it is a bad sign. It suggests that the Saudis are unwilling to essentially admit that they made a mistake when they entered this war, and that they can't gain control over Yemen. And that admission would require a big change in policy, and right now they're not under enough pressure to do it. The oil prices have gone up. The Saudis are doing okay financially. They apparently are under no pressure whatsoever from the Biden administration to roll back or extend the truce or negotiate a lasting peace. So I don't see any indication, unfortunately, that the truce will continue.
Yemeni officials have, however, expressed their doubt over a third extension of the ceasefire. They say the UN has failed to bring the much-needed breathing room for civilians. Another matter which seems to be behind the Yemenis' doubt is the Saudi-led coalition refusing to fully commit to the terms of the truce, including halting its attacks.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
Hussein, 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 Hussein.
I cry for you in pain. I cry.